Thank you all for coming. It's a real pleasure to be here. I really appreciate being invited here for this year. It's going to be a very exciting year for me and for the rest of us. So now that I see that this seems to work, I will move the screen up and do something to turn this on mute or something. Maybe I'll just do that. And what I'd like to tell you about is just a nice piece of my thesis that I did at Cornell, and it'll fit nicely into one lecture and illustrate a technique from one variable dynamics in a way to prove a theorem in two variable dynamics. Okay, so what I'm interested in is Newton's method in two variables for solving very, very simple equations. In general, I'm interested in solving for the intersection of two quadratics in C2. But for the purpose of this lecture, we'll intersect a quadratic with an even simpler quadratic. Okay? So I guess I'll get started here. Let's just consider the two quadratics. P of xy is x times 1 minus x. Okay. The simplest quadratic, or one of them. Q of xy is equal to y squared minus bxy minus y. Okay. So somehow this is an incredibly easy system of two equations to solve. You can solve and you find that P equals 0, Q equals 0, Q equals 0 gives you the roots R1 equals 0, 0, R2 equals 0, 1, R3 equals 1, 0, and R4, depending upon the parameter B, is equal to 1, 1 minus B. So solving these equations is not the goal, obviously. The goal is to consider what happens if you use Newton's method to solve these equations. So let's just write the system for P and Q being 0 as F of xy is equal to P of xy, Q of xy is equal to 0. And we can write down the Newton map. This is no big deal. The Newton map is always, you would just write down N. I'll index it sub F initially to indicate that it depends upon F. And then quickly I'll forget to write F because it'll be understood. So N sub F of xy is equal to, well, as always, xy minus bf inverse at xy times f of xy. And I'll spare you the details of the calculation, and I'll just write it down for this f. Okay. So for this f, we get n sub f of xy is equal to, well, there's some simplification because the first equation depends just on x. You get x squared over 2x minus 1, and then there will be some big messy equation of which I'll try not to use the details too much, but sometimes we need them. So the big messy equation is y times bx squared plus 2xy minus bx, and of course I have restricted myself too much, bx minus y all over 2x minus 1 times bx plus 2y minus 1. This system, you'll notice, of course, that it's the first component of the system depends just on x. So really, the dynamics of the system should be simpler than some general dynamical system in two complex variables. This simplification is called the skew product. Systems where the first variable behaves independently and second, third, or nth variables depend upon all of the variables, it's called the skew product. So this is called the skew product. So if you see skew products in the literature, that's the class of system. And we could even write this as x squared over 2x minus 1. and I'll write R sub x of y. So here's a rational mapping of degree 2 in y depending upon x. So it really ties nicely into the theory of one variable maps this way, but somehow things are a little bit messier. So let me just go over some of the basic properties of this mapping, and then I'll state what I plan to prove, and we can go into that. I also welcome questions, of course, at any point. Questions? Say that just a little bit louder. There will be a theorem about this particular system. So, in fact, my thesis is entirely based upon this particular system. You might think of many people have proven results on x squared plus c. So this is some sort of model system, in a way. And it's hard enough for me. Was there another question? Okay. So my theorem will be just on this system. Okay, so let's just establish some of the properties of this system. Well, the first thing you ask in dynamics is, where are the critical values? Well, we have two variables, so we have a set of critical values. We have a critical value locus, some curve of critical values. You can check that the critical values is the parabola in C2, is the parabola C of xy, is y squared plus bxy plus b squared over 4 x squared minus b squared over 4 x minus y equals 0. It's sort of unfortunate that there are so many details in the equations, but once there are sort of six or so of these equations that you have to remember or be able to look up, and then you can work with them. So sometimes I'll just call this C. I'll put quotes here. C will mean the equation and the locus. Okay. So one difference between complex dynamics and two variables and one variable is that in one variable, you typically look where the critical values are mapped to. In two variables, you can look within the critical value locus and see structure just within that, instead of just on some, you don't have just a point or many points. You have an actual curve you can look at. I'll draw pictures on the computer of the intersection of this curve with the basin of attractions, the basins of attraction of these four roots. So it's somehow a difference for two variable or many variable dynamics. So let me also mention another property is that the degree, the topological degree of this mapping is 4. A generic point has 4 inverse images. So degree top of n equals 4. A generic point, I say top because in many variables, once again, you can have a distinction between the algebraic degree of your equations and the number of inverse images of a generic point. In this case, if you look at this, the mapping, a given x, as long as x is not a malign x equals 0 or x equals 1, you can check that that x has 2 inverse images. And then as long as you're off of this critical value locus, you have a rational map of degree 2 in y, and you get 2 inverse images of the y. Probably just believe that for now or check later. Okay. So let me mention another thing that we'll use. Ah, yes. So there are points, as Professor Shub has mentioned, there are points where you can't even define the Newton map, where the DF inverse isn't defined. And I'll mention these briefly today, and then for those who come to the mini course on Tuesday and Thursday, I'll have to address this in really quite a great detail. We do blow-ups to resolve these points of indeterminacy. But I know I've had people be allergic to this. So. Isn't naturally defined on the entire critical locus. Actually, it is. this is where the derivative is. This is where the mapping is critical. This is where n is critical. Critical locus for n. Yes. So this is of the dynamics. F will have a critical locus, and the critical locus for F will lead to indeterminacy in n. There are actually points where n is not defined. Yeah. Critical values. You can pull it back and get the critical points locus. Okay, and thank you for the distinction. So in fact, n is defined on this entire locus, and knowing how n is defined on this locus will be very important for more for the mini course. So let me just say, as you often do in one variable dynamics, I want to compactify, at least in the second variable, so that this rational mapping, R sub X of Y, is a map from the Riemann sphere to the Riemann sphere. So let me just say, compactify. So we really get, this is in quotes again, we're getting N from C cross P1 to C cross P1. This is X, Y, is in there. I don't entirely compactify, because there's this problem with the points of indeterminacy of n that can happen if you have a compact range and domain. And I just don't. There's a reason why I'm not compactifying in both variables. And I can explain this later sometime if anybody is interested. Okay. And the last thing to mention of these basic facts is, well, the first component is the Newton's method for finding for the polynomial in one variable with roots at 0 and 1. So a Newton's method for a quadratic polynomial is very simple. This is something initially known to Cayley, I think, but I, as Jampolsky mentioned, you choose one of the six names that you remember from the period and hope it's the right one. He only mentioned two. This is known to Cayley. So this is in the dynamics in X. We have 0, 1, and the result known to Cayley is that the dynamics, the Julia set of this Newton map, is the line of equidistance between the two roots. And everything on one side of the line is attracted to 0, in fact, super attracted when you get close enough. And everything on the other side of the line is attracted to 1. This gives us a decomposition of C cross P1 into three pieces. Those points which are over the basin of attraction of 0 in X, those points which are over the basin attraction of 1 in X, and those points above the Julia set. So let me just say, well, a decomposition C cross P1 is equal to XL union X 1/2 union XR, X because X is some good label, L for to the left, so this is equal to the set of XY such that real X less than 1/2. This is equal to the set where real X equals 1/2. And this is equal to the set where real X is greater than 1/2. By this comment about the dynamics in the first variable, these sets, each of these sets is invariant under N. So I'll often, especially later in the mini course, I'll often think just about dynamics in XL or just about dynamics in XR. In fact, I don't know how to prove much about dynamics in X1/2, so I'll rarely mention it. Somehow we're just talking about things corresponding to Fatou components the basins of attraction, and therefore these problems are hard enough. So I'm not going to even look at dynamics where one variable dynamics people would consider the dynamics interesting. Okay. So are there any other comments before we get moving? Aha. There are a couple more comments to set the stage for this thing. N itself has points of indeterminacy. At the following points, P is equal to 1 over B, 0, and Q is equal to 1 over 2 minus B, 1 minus B over 2 minus B. N is not defined. The definition of N at these points will depend upon the direction at which you approach these points. For those with a background in differential geometry or algebraic geometry, you can extend N to a blow-up at each of these points, and that will give you a resolution of the singularity. But for today's purposes, just know that you can do this if you have to, and don't worry about it from there on. Okay. Another remaining thing to mention is these are the dynamics in X. If we look in the line above X equals 0, the line in Y above X equals 0, or in the line in Y above X equals 1, we also have simpler dynamics. So if we look in the line X equals 0, here's a line, the dynamics is just, well, you put X equals 0 into this equation, and you just get, well, you get Y squared, N of 0, y is equal to y squared over 2y minus 1. Yeah, the signs cancel out. So this is R sub 0 of y. This is the dynamics on the vertical complex line above x equals 0. In particular, this dynamics is the same as that dynamics over there. So we've got some picture of this line, and there's 0, 1. There's this separator, which is a vertical line. Although, in this case, this is now P1. So this is actually a circle separating the basin of attraction of 0 from the basin of attraction of 1 within this line. I'll call this circle S0, sub-0, denoting that it's above x equals 0. What I'm going to do in this talk, hopefully, is explain how S0 has a superstable three-dimensional manifold. S0 is an invariant set of N. Everybody see that? So let me just say, so here's some invariant set, and we'll see how to create some invariant manifold. Yes? S0 is exactly the locus x equals 0, real part of y equals 1/2. The picture is like the following. You've got, here's X, portrayed as a one-dimensional real thing, which it isn't. Here's Y, portrayed as a one-dimensional real thing. This is the line here. this whole line here is the vertical axis, and this point is the analog of S0 in this depiction. The root R2 is here, the root R1 is here. There's another vertical line, x equals 1, and the root R4 is here, and the root R3 is there. Okay? I'm not proving these things, I'm just giving background, so we can prove something. S0 is in fact this locus. It's not just a point, it's a circle. But I'm just depicting it as a single point, because I can't quite draw the whole thing. Yeah. You could try to draw it like if you think of x as one-dimensional and this as the y-planes, then S0 is, well, it's this circle. Here's y equals 0, y equals 1. And it's actually a circle because you're connecting up the ends at infinity. Yeah. The map, good. Necessary information that I was going to forget to say. The map on S0 is conjugate to angle doubling. Is conjugate to angle doubling on the unit circle. So, yes, the whole map on this plane is conjugate to z squared. The map on the circle is conjugate to angle doubling. So, let me look very close to the circle, and I'll try to prove this theorem that I wanted to prove. Let me just mention one other comment. Okay, let me do that first. So, I need that. You'll notice also that this is S0. S0 is super attracting in the x direction. This whole plane, this is the plane x equals 0, the complex line, if you will. This whole plane is super attracting in the x direction. Because x equals 0 is super attracting independently of y. So somehow we have super attraction. In one complex dimension in x. I see people questioning things. Can I answer any question? Okay. It's super attracting in one complex dimension, in the x dimension. And this circle, because the map is conjugate to z goes to z squared, this circle is hyperbolically repelling with multiplier 2 within this line. Okay? So these arrows mean outside of the line, and blue will mean inside of the line. Inside of the line, this circle is hyperbolically repelling with multiplier 2. That's the setup that I'm trying to present. People comfortable with that? Okay, good. I see a consensus of people nodding, So let me just mention, before I try to prove this theorem, I wanted to show why these manifolds are assumed to exist by looking on the computer. For any point with real part of x less than 1/2, this point will be super attracted to this line x equals 0, because the dynamics in x are super attracting to 0. For any point, and therefore, any point will either be attracted to 1 within this plane, 0 within this plane, or maybe, just maybe, to this circle. So we expect, if we look at slices in C2 and color points according to their base to the one, which of the four roots they converge to, we expect to see sort of almost everything converging to one root or the other thing, other root, and some sort of a divider. This divider is the manifold that I propose to show you. So let me just show you that, and then I'll prove that it actually is there. So yeah, there's a screen. In at Cornell, we just push everything up, and then there's white. The picture that I will show you is within a parameterization of the critical value parabola. The critical value parabola is in fact, it's biholomorphic to just a complex plane in the naive sense of a one-dimensional complex thing. And so we can parameterize, we can go through this slice, take this parameterization into C2, and color the points according to whether they go to root 1, root 2, root 3, or root 4. So let me just, this program that I'll use is a really nice one called Fractalasm, generated by an undergraduate student working with Professor Hubbard. And it's been really useful in making conjectures about what I should try to prove. Smooth what? Smooth Roach. I'll tell you later. So what I'll do is I'll get myself a parameter window. So this first plane you'll see is B. You'll see something that looks oddly familiar in this plane, and I'm not going to explain until afterwards, if anybody is interested, why this should look familiar, kind of. Now, let me just, I want to make a bigger region here. Okay, this looks Mandelbrot set-ish. That has to do with the analytic conjugacy class very near one of these four roots. Ignore that for the moment. I'm interested in how this divider, whatever it is that I'll be proving. So imagine this as just a way to choose a point. It's a parameter B. And it's colored according to something that I'm not planning to explain. But the next picture is something I plan to explain. This is colored according to which root you go to. For one of the roots that you go to, there's some local dynamics near the root that's a rational map. And this is some pre-chosen special point. Just some pre-chosen point that, not even a special critical point, just some point. If there's no good point that we're using for that. Just think of this as a way to choose a parameter for now. So I've chosen a parameter. Here is a parameterization of C. You'll see the roots. Can you see the cursor there? One of the roots is there. Is this a laser pointer? One of the roots is there. One of the roots, well, I can't quite see the level curves very well. One of the roots is roughly there. This is the critical value parabola C. So instead of looking where the critical points go, we're looking within the critical value parabola. All four roots are there. It ends up that it goes through the four roots. So the blue basin goes to this root, which is roughly there. The gray basin goes to this root, which is roughly there. The green one to this root, and the red one to this root. And somehow, you're seeing that there's some interplay between the red and the green basins, divided up by some curves of some class of smoothness, whatever that class is in this. It ends up that these curves are, in fact, can be described locally as the zero set of a harmonic function. So that's what the smoothness class is. So let me get a more interesting parameter value. Are there any questions about this first picture? Exactly. So if you just happen to choose a point on the critical value locus C that's right within this little green bubble, instead of going to that root which is closer to it, it'll eventually go over close to the green root and converge to the green root. And this separator is what I plan to prove exists, which will prove that there aren't any points outside of real x equals 1/2 that don't either converge to one of the four roots or converge to one of the two, to either this invariant circle in the line x equals 0 or to the invariant circle in the line x equals 1, which I haven't mentioned. Question? So this curve, C of xy equals, this algebraic equation equals 0, is some curve in C2. This curve is a parabola, so it actually is C, and this is a subset of C. Let me just show you that these manifolds can get very complicated. Let me choose one. So here's one where the colors have changed, but both pairs of basins. So there are two basins in XL with points which have real part less than 1/2 and two basins with real part greater than 1/2. And this time there's a divider between the green and the red and also a divider between the gray and the blue. Okay. And yes. Aha. So I'm hoping not to explain that. Can I explain it to you after the talk? Because I'll get sidetracked. There's different kinds of bifurcations in this system. There are bifurcations of the topological type of the basins and bifurcations of the analytic type of the mapping. And that's a parameter space of how the analytic type at one of the roots changes. I wasn't planning to, but I can. Or I can explain it to you sometime, some other time. Okay. So it's a different locus than the bifurcation locus for how these curves dividing the basins up change. It lives in B. This is the B plane. This is the B plane colored according to some mysterious for now description. Okay. So there are lots of these complicated pictures, and if you zoom in, you see that they get very complicated. The smooth curve that you see slicing this up corresponds to real x equals 1/2 intersecting this parabola. Near real x equals 1/2, you expect the dynamics to get more and more complicated, because that's where the Julia set is. And if you zoom in here, you get really, really quite complicated geometry. Okay. So let me prove for you that these separators exist. I've got, I guess, 20 minutes to do it. Does this end at 4:10 or at 4? 4:10. So let me prove to you that these separators exist in 20 minutes. This is where the actual math lies. I'm just trying to build up to what I should show you. Yes. It's hard to get to the point where I can formulate it, but now I am ready to. For this specific Newton's method, yes. Exactly. Certain, in fact, three real dimensional surfaces, hypersurfaces. So let me state the following. So recall that S0 is equal to the set where x equals 0, real y equals 1/2. This set is invariant under n. With zero multiplier, multiplier in x direction, I'll put like that because there are really two real directions, and two multiplier in the normal direction in the y plane, in the x equals 0 plane. So we've got this invariant circle. Yeah, sure. So the statement of the theorem is this theorem is along the lines of the ideas of Sebastian Krief, who was a student of Hubbard before me, and I've collected it here in some form that I'm using. So S0 has a local superstable manifold which I'm going to call W0 loc. Now, of course, that's just giving this thing a word for this thing. So more precisely, there exists U0, a neighborhood of 0, contained in C, a neighborhood of 0, so that and a set W R loc, W zero loc contained in X L, some set such that, well, it's invariant under n. And W0 loc is the image of phi from U0 cross S0 into XL, where phi is analytic in the first variable and quasi-conformal in the second variable.
No,
So, Hubbard and I were worried about this not being a consequence of some standard theory. Him more than me. And he told me 3 weeks before I should turn in my thesis, "So, Roland, how do you plan to prove this?" "Oh, hell, I don't know. The standard theory." Because I was focusing on the global topology of these things. And then he said, "Well, Sebastian Krief has developed most of this method, and you should read his notes." So there were some notes in French. I couldn't understand them really, but Hubbard and I talked about it, and the result is what I plan to show you. So it may follow from some standard results, but this is kind of cool because you don't have to use some standard graph transform methods. I plan to use the lambda lemma, so you can, instead of using some knowledge about real analysis, you can use knowledge about complex analysis. It's totally different. And it can be used in some cases when the map isn't uniformly hyperbolically attracting. Hubbard has a proof with the case where there are dense sets of points in the circle where you have normal derivative with multiplier 1. And if anybody's curious about that, I can point them to the reference. So, but I'll do the easy case. Easier. So let me just do the following. We, of course, want to change variables so that this mapping looks, so that things look more like you have an invariant circle, and so the mapping is more reasonable. So what we will do is we will do the change of variables z of x equals x over x minus 1, that's just an x, w of y equals y over y minus 1. We get n of zw is equal to, well, z squared, good, w squared plus bw minus b squared w z minus w squared z squared all over 1 plus b minus b w z plus b w squared plus b minus 1 minus 2 b w z squared, which you'll notice if you put z equals 0 is w squared. So our invariant circle is now, S0 is now 0 comma W such that modulus of W is equal to 1. This is a more reasonable setup for proving this kind of theorem. We were trying to work with Newton's method, so we were thinking about it in an unusual way, but this is the way we'll work about with it. So because we want this to be a local theorem, we will restrict our attention to, we work in d epsilon cross the Riemann sphere, where d epsilon is the unit disk of radius, open unit disk of radius epsilon. Okay. Now, I'm going to do something that'll seem like the graph transform argument at first, and then when the analysis comes about, I'll do something different. Okay. So we want to create a domain which is with the following properties. So we'll let delta sub epsilon, small delta, be the set of ZW in XL, such that, well, z is less than epsilon, and 1 minus delta is less than modulus w is less than 1 plus delta. It's an open neighborhood of the circle. Okay? Now, what we want epsilon and delta so that the following two conditions hold, and then things will be easy. So
so that...
Well, let me just make an aside. This thing has what I'll call the vertical boundary and what I'll call the horizontal boundary.
It's sort of in the obvious way.
Boundary vertical of delta epsilon delta is equal to the set where modulus of z equals epsilon. Boundary horizontal of delta epsilon delta is equal to the set where modulus of w is equal to 1 plus or minus delta. Okay. So, what I want is I want to choose epsilon and delta so that first, delta epsilon delta is disjoint from the critical value locus of n. And I'll put a prime here to indicate that this is now in terms of z and w, the critical value locus. Okay? And two, so that n of the horizontal boundary is outside and n of the vertical boundary is in inside of z less than or equal to epsilon. Let me draw this in a picture. Another question? Aha. So I'm using my English in a very, very slightly sloppy way. I'm talking about the critical locus excluding the vertical line z equals 0 and the vertical line z equals infinity. With the parabola. And I'm just talking about the parabola, which now isn't a parabola anymore in these new coordinates, but it's some curve. Okay. And Professor Jampolsky looks exceptionally amused, which is excellent. That's for Professor Hubbard to do. Notice how I'm not using somehow, somewhat, in some way as much as other speakers have in the probability. But I feel sympathetic in some way. So let me draw a picture, which I will put where? I will put it up here. So the whole picture... Now, once again, it's a picture that you can't quite draw because everything's real four-dimensional. But I will draw the z-coordinate as one real-dimensional and the w-coordinate as two real-dimensional. So I should look at my cheat sheet here. Yeah, it's pretty bad. Okay. And within here, we have some smaller tube. And then we have S0, which I will draw in a different color so you can find it. S0 is here. And I forgot to draw this. Delta epsilon delta. This is n of delta epsilon delta. And it's drawn so that it satisfies property 2. The vertical boundary is here and here, and it's mapped. This is the set where modulus z is less than epsilon. The vertical boundary is mapped with inside this set. The horizontal boundary is mapped outside. The outer piece is mapped outside this way. The inner piece is mapped outside this way. So this picture is depicting condition 2. If you allow z to be 1 or ill-dimensional. So what I guess I would do is let me just say it's not hard to satisfy condition 1 because in the x, y variables, the near the line x equals 0, the critical value parabola went through the two roots and so in fact was quite far from s0. So, and it's transverse to that line. So it's not hard to, so it's transverse to the line z equals 0 in these new coordinates, and it's somehow far enough from s0 that this isn't a problem. You can check this. I don't want to focus on that. And the second thing, well, you can get both of these conditions just by making epsilon and delta smaller. I don't want to focus too much on that. Plausible? I can show the details to people who want to see them later. But now what I've proposed to do is to show you somehow how to construct most of this superstable manifold by hand and then apply the lambda lemma to take its closure. So let me just state a lemma up here and then we'll just use it. By construction, if D contained in this set is a complex disk, given as the graph of an analytic function on Z, this is the unit disk of radius epsilon, then an inverse of D intersect delta epsilon delta is exactly 2 disjoint disks, also given by the graphs of analytic functions. I'll just write is 2 such disks. To disjoint such disks. On half the domain? No. Because it's expanding. So I could draw for instance, so it's on a bigger domain than you restrict. So for instance, you might choose some disk. Oh, I'm sorry, it needs to be on the you choose some disk like that, you take the inverse images, and it actually goes out even further. Because what specifies how its behavior is within delta epsilon delta is only within the smaller region n of delta epsilon delta. Okay. Now, by how we compactified the map to C cross P1. In the original variables, the line y equals infinity was invariant, and in fact, attracted to this circle. So what I will say is that the line above 1 in S0, we'll put 1 here. The straight line above 1 is within this proposed superstable manifold. So this is the first piece. Now we take its inverse image, and we get lines above 1 and, well, square root of, well, 1 and its inverse image. So we get a line here, and then a line down here that's not, it's not quite a line. Now it's the graph of an analytic function. They're disjoint. So now we'll take the second inverse images above the line 1, and we'll get complex disks that are the graphs of analytic functions through the 4 roots of unity on the on S0. The other one is back here somewhere. Okay. This whole set is mapped within itself by construction. And each leaf is the graph of an analytic function. I started with some forward invariant line. The line, the first one, which I will call D0, is just the line W equals 1. And then I'm taking repeated inverse images. So you do the nth inverse image, you get 2 to the n disks given by graphs of analytic functions going through the 2 to the n dyadic points on the circle. Okay, I'll call that set Dn is equal to n to the minus n of D0 intersect delta, which I'll use as an abbreviation for delta epsilon delta. And, well, I'm going to call D infinity to be the union of Dn, n equals 1 to infinity. This is somehow a family of complex disks, which are graphs of holomorphic functions going through the dyadic points on S0. And, well, an alternative description is that they form a holomorphic motion of the dyadic points on the circle. So let me just say what this is very quickly. I'm sorry that this is taking so long. So just a holomorphic motion is a psi from lambda cross E into P1, where E is contained in P1. Lambda is a complex manifold satisfying psi of dot comma Z holomorphic for each Z, and 2 lambda of, sorry, psi of lambda comma dot is injective for each lambda. This lambda lemma states that if you have a holomorphic motion like so, then it extends to a holomorphic motion of the closure of E and is quasi-conformal, and each the map for each lambda is quasi-conformal. So, lambda lemma extends, this is, I'm being very vague, I apologize, extends, I apologize. Z is whatever I plan it to be. I didn't have a lot of time to prepare this talk, so I'm sorry about that. This extends to E bar. Provides a holomorphic motion in E bar and is quasi-conformal in the second coordinate in the neighborhood of E bar. So, this, you could define a holomorphic motion psi from the dyadic points. This is the dyadic points cross the disk of radius epsilon into XL by psi of D comma Z is equal to, well, you take the leaf going through D and you follow the leaf to Z. That's all it is. So it's given by the local defining function of the leaf through D. So this extends to psi from S0 cross D epsilon into XL, because the closure of the dyadic points is the circle. And this, the image of this map is, in fact, well, it's invariant under N, and this is the superstable manifold we wanted to create.
So what helps your theory is that you happen to know one stable manifold.
Yes. Yes. I had one and I could, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So to make the manifolds that you saw in the computer pictures, you have to pull this back and pull this back and pull this back. You can prove regularity by showing that there's some real analytic function that vanishes on this locus. And so you get that these curves really have some control in their geometry. Yes, that was crucial.
Well, I guess you can take anything and then take invariant.
But you need to take something that's already invariant.
Well, eventually the limit should be invariant.
Aha. Uh-huh. But that's true if you throw away the first ones, or if you weight things so that the first ones don't count. For instance, like forming an invariant current by taking the inverse images of fundamental classes. Or like forming the measure that you do in one variable dynamics where you take a point that's not exceptional and you pull the point measure back.
But you just take the denote and take the inverse image.
Yeah.
Just forget about the previous
one. Aha. So this denote, if it weren't already within the invariant set that I wanted, because things are normally repelling, the inverse image. No, I guess it would probably be okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think it would be okay, actually. It just happened to be easy to have D-naught with this property. So, in this case, or they're holomorphic. Every disk is given as the graph of a holomorphic function. For all lambda, meaning for any dyadic point. For any point. Aha. No, I don't think they are. Oh, actually they are, because this extends to a holomorphic motion of the closure. By definition of a holomorphic motion. Yes. Yes. So that's all, of course. Any other questions? Yeah, there's a few different lambda lemmas, but I'm sorry if you came here under the wrong impression of what you would see, but I doubt that you did. Basically, lambda can replace lambda. So for the mini course, what I plan to do is I plan to use how these superstable manifolds separate the basins of attraction of the roots to prove the theorem that I proved in my thesis, which states that for most parameter values, so for all parameter values, two of the basins have infinitely generated first homology. And the other pair of roots, there's sort of two pairs. There's the pair in the vertical line at x equals 0 and the pair in the vertical line at x equals 1. So I'll prove that one of the pairs, the basins, always have infinitely generated first homology. Yes. It's an ambitious goal, I hope. And in the other case, in some special cases, the basins are actually contractible. So there's a bifurcation from basins being contractible to having infinitely generated first homology. So I plan to try to explain that in the mini course. So hopefully if you find that interesting, you can come to the mini course. Thank you. What's that?
Is there a registration fee for the course, or is it dropping
in? Drop in as you please, of course.
Well,
yeah.
So those two basins, direct and was it direct?
The red and the green?
Probably. Those which had like those bulbs.
Yeah.
So those are the ones with infinite homology?
Yeah. In fact, they always have those bulbs. But that's not how I prove that they have infinitely generated homology. It's hard to explain why they have those. So I use something different. But
how does it work? If you pick a point from one of those Greenwich bulbs and they're in the whatever the other color.
Yeah.
Do they might be a stupid question. Do they follow first travel within the bulb within from bulb to bulb and then jump to the main bulb?
I don't know. Yeah. Basically, yeah, I think I don't think yeah, I don't know. Because in fact, at least they don't the ball within this picture, they don't go from the ball to the ball, because the set of points in this plane that stay in this plane under one iteration is just some finite set of points. So probably not. But somehow things are broken up into pieces nicely in the, if you look at vertical lines x equals constant, you can get pieces that are cut into the right kinds of pieces. And you can take their boundaries and link them with the right thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds good.